Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Sam Anderson is an award-winning staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, formerly a book critic for the same. His first book, Boomtown, the fantastical saga of Oklahoma City, its chaotic founding, its purloined basketball team, and the dream of becoming a world-class metropolis, was released this summer. Boomtown hops around the fascinating story of Oklahoma's capital city, which is like zooming in on a sped-up story of America, with everything that entails. Dream attainment and major success for some. Land ownership, enormous civic pride perhaps only outmatched by civic confusion, power struggles, architecture that goes up too fast, solid and stately buildings that get knocked down too soon in the name of progress, the unfortunate truths that generate the necessity for an inspiring civil rights movement, sports, rock and roll, and terror. Oklahoma City also boasts more than a few events that could safely be called uniquely its own, with one example being Operation Bongo. In 1964, the Federal Aviation Administration used various aircraft to generate sonic booms over Oklahoma City to test their effect on structures and public attitude. The public attitude was largely, quit it with the sonic booms. Once again, the name of the book is Boomtown, the fantastical saga of Oklahoma City, its chaotic founding, its purloined basketball team, and the dream of becoming a world-class metropolis. Sam Anderson, author of my favorite book this year. Welcome back to the Roundtable.
Thank you very much.
Sure. So we have to start at the beginning, and then we'll jump around a bunch.
Cool.
What brought you to Oklahoma City?
People sometimes assume I'm from Oklahoma City. I'm not. And I had no reason to be interested in Oklahoma City. I was one day standing in my editor's office at the New York Times Magazine, where I'm a staff writer.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And he said, hey, we want you to write some, you know, big, colorful, splashy cover story. I said, sure. He said, what's it going to be about? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, you like basketball. I've been a basketball fan since I was a kid and a very bad pickup basketball player. I'm not a sports writer by any means. And he said, what about this team in Oklahoma City? They seem interesting. And I said, they're definitely interesting. They had at the time three of the youngest kind of budding superstars in sports, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, James Harden. They had been quote unquote stolen. They used to be the Seattle Supersonics for decades, and then they were suddenly transplanted to Oklahoma City, which in many ways is a place that just didn't deserve to have something as big and serious as a pro basketball franchise. So it's this brand new team in this new place with these young dynamic stars, and they had a few years before been one of the worst teams in all of sports, and suddenly they were one of the very best, and they had just lost actually to LeBron James in the NBA Finals, which no one expected them to get to. So I said, they're fascinating. And he said, well, just go out there and see what's happening in Oklahoma City. So it was kind of as casual as that. As soon as I started heading in that direction, I kind of started how I always do, which is reading a big pile of books. And I was reading this history of Oklahoma. And I started encountering these stories of things in American history that I just had no idea about and could not believe happened on planet Earth. And so I think kind of by the time I landed to write the story about the basketball team and its relationship to the city, I knew it was a bigger story than just that. It grew into this book project that kind of ate my life for over 5 years.
You are a writer. You're a critic and a writer for the New York Times Magazine, but this is your first book.
Yes.
And so this feeling you had about Oklahoma City was the first time a big feeling was big enough to delve into for a whole book.
And I'd been waiting for that feeling my entire career, because all of my writing heroes write these big, ambitious nonfiction books, you know, John McPhee, Annie Dillard. Like, I always wanted to write a book, this kind of lyrical, strange thing. And I would get emails as I wrote, you know, magazine stories about this and that. I'd get emails from publishers or editors or agents saying, would you consider writing a book about this? And I always just said no, because it wasn't the idea. It wasn't the thing. I didn't have the feeling. Oklahoma City, for the first time in my life, gave me that feeling. I never expected it to come from that place. And that made it even more fun somehow. It was like, I've been swept away by a crazy project.
When you grew up on the West Coast, you live on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a crazy surprise in the middle.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's a place I think that, you know, sometimes when I tell people what my book is about, I see their eyes glaze over and they're not like, I'm not from Oklahoma. I've never been. I have no interest in the place. And I think we are conditioned in a way to, you know, ignore that part of the continent. Flyover country, we call it sometimes. That was part of the appeal too. I grew up in Oregon, and I remember that feeling growing up that I was far away from the places where things really mattered in the culture. Like I had this idea that, you know, LA and New York were the places where real things happened, not where I was. And so I liked that challenge in writing about Oklahoma City, was like, here's a place most people look past, and what's actually happening here, and what is happening there is fascinating.
Allow me to quote you at you.
Okay.
You wrote in an essay that's in the New York Times Magazine, I think it was published the day your book came out, Letter mm-hmm. of Recommendation, Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. You wrote, it was a pure distillation of our nation's essential weirdness, a bouillon cube of America. Expand on that. Let's start kind of blowing that up.
Right.
Taking out the components of this cube.
Right. Yeah. That's one thing that became clear to me, was for all of its strangenesses, Oklahoma City is a place that contains really the entire history of the United States, just compressed to a ridiculous degree. So the city is the youngest major city in America. It was born very, very late in American history, in 1889. And it was born in a way that no other city has ever been created, which is in this wacky event called the Land Run, where you had this patch of land that was about half the size of Connecticut. Pretty big patch of land in the center of America, in the center of an area that was at the time called Indian Territory, for various complex reasons having to do with the Civil War and some tribes that sided with the South during the Civil War. This land was suddenly unoccupied. The tribes who had it were relocated outside of it. And so you had this...
Against their will, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You had this huge patch of land right in the center of America that was suddenly unoccupied. And again, this is in the 1880s, and so, or starting in the late 1860s. But after the time when we think of, you know, people rushing for land, gold rushes, all that kind of stuff had kind of settled down. America was settled.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you had this open patch, and people in the states around it noticed that and started harassing the federal government to let them settle the land. And they actually started leading raids into this territory. These white settler groups from Kansas started sneaking through the edges of Indian Territory into the middle of what was called the unassigned lands, and kind of trying to prove to the government that they would make great things of it. So they would like sneak in there and they would build these kind of crazy cities in the middle of the prairie, where they would just sort of mow elaborate street plans and everything, to show what they were capable of before being arrested and kicked out. So eventually, after many years of this kind of harassment, the federal government said, fine, we'll let settlers have it. And the way we're going to do it is the worst idea ever, which is we're just going to allow anyone who wants a piece of this land to come line up around the border. And at noon on one day, April 22nd, 1889, we're going to blow some bugles and fire some guns, and everyone can just race for it and claim what they can claim. That was the beginning of Oklahoma, and Oklahoma City was one of the cities that was founded on that day, that went from population zero to population roughly 10,000.
It's bananas.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And it is like, it's like a sort of like absurd cartoon parody.
Yeah, and asking people to kill each other. A little bit.
Yeah, right. Yeah, everyone was heavily armed. Mm-hmm. Everyone is, you know, half starved and freezing and racing. And yeah, there are all these crazy stories of people falling off their horses and breaking their necks, or somebody shooting a gun to speed up his horse and accidentally shooting another settler. And there's these incredible stories of cheating. People were kind of camping out in the trees and in the bushes. There's an incredible scene at what became Oklahoma City, which should have taken people about an hour to get to from the border of the unassigned lands. Well, right when the bugle was blown, people just started falling out of the trees and popping out of ditches.
Sure.
And they had just been hiding out. And a whole crew of surveyors came popping out of the bushes and laying out streets to try to sell to the other settlers when they finally got there. It was just complete chaos. So you have a city that starts in this way that's absolutely bonkers. And then pretty much every motion of its history from that moment on is this kind of excessive, absurd exaggeration of what a normal American city would do. So that's part of why I wanted to tell this story. It felt like the story of every single American city, just kind of compressed.
And magnified,
yeah.
Where do we go from here? Because there's so much contained in the tale.
It's really an overstuffed story. Yeah, there's too many things happened.
So let's just jump, if you don't mind, then, to civil rights, which is a huge, an enormous part of a national story as well. And it also has some incredible heroes.
And it's something I had never heard Oklahoma City mentioned, you know, in the conversation of, until I started really digging into the history of this place, kind of trace the whole history of the Black community in Oklahoma City. Because, of course, when the land run happened, it wasn't really for Black settlers to come in and claim land. This was almost entirely white crowds of people rushing for this land. So the Black community mostly came in later in the weeks following the land run, after the dust had kind of settled, and took the poorest land left near the river where it was flooding constantly, things like that, took the worst jobs in the town. And Oklahoma was an extremely segregated place from the moment it was an official state. So I traced this history of people kind of pushing back. And one of the great heroes I found, it was someone I'd never heard of, a woman named Clara Looper, who I really think should be a national hero in the civil rights movement, because she led a series of sit-ins in downtown Oklahoma City that started in 1958, which is well before, you know, the Greensboro sit-ins and the other sit-ins that we really think of as the civil rights touchstones. And she was this incredibly magnetic, charismatic character. She was a school teacher in Oklahoma City, and she led the NAACP Youth Council, which included her own children and a bunch of other children from the east side of town. And she took them on a trip to Washington, D.C., and they went through the north. And suddenly these kids from Oklahoma City could sit down in restaurants and order things like anyone else, and they just couldn't believe how great it felt. And then on the way home, they came back through the South and suddenly faced segregation again. And when they got back to Oklahoma City, these little kids who were, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old said, "We just can't take this anymore. We can't live like this. Let's go down to a place called Cat's Drugs in the middle of Oklahoma City, and let's just sit down at the soda fountain counter and let's order some Cokes and see what happens." And so they did that. And there was a big uproar, and they kept at it. And they did it for a few days until Cat's agreed to integrate. And then they moved on to the next restaurant. And then they moved through systematically through the city for 6 years until everything was integrated. And a lot of the later sit-in demonstrations across the country cited Clara Looper and what these kids did, because it was really this very early example of a sustained movement that really worked and that never turned violent. Clara Looper was great at working with the police and really appealing to the shop owners before they started all of this. And she was just this like really funny, weird character. She would sit at these demonstrations and write all these crazy poems, and she would tell jokes to the waitresses. And I mean, this is all while people are, you know, pouring coffee on the kids deliberately and pushing them off of stools and spitting on them. And she just had this kind of incredible joy that was able to sustain that movement. I got to meet her daughter last time I was in Oklahoma City, who was in those original sit-ins, and it was like such a thrill.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. And then there's also Roscoe Dungy.
Yeah, there's this guy named Roscoe Dungy who back in the early days, his dad actually came a little bit after the land run, and he was a Baptist missionary, and he brought Roscoe Dungy. He was a little kid at the time, and Roscoe grew up and started the great Black newspaper of Oklahoma City. It's called the Black Dispatch. He was another of these characters who was just like indomitable, and he just pushed back against the kind of white propagandistic version of the news from his perch at this little tiny newspaper on the east side, where he was just like really scraping together money to keep it running and, you know, telling the truth about the lynchings that were going on, and then using his place in that community to push back legally against the Jim Crow laws. And he got hooked into the NAACP when it was a brand new institution in the teens, in the 19-teens. After some decades, he was running the NAACP. He was working with Thurgood Marshall to fight against Jim Crow laws. He was expanding the neighborhoods that black residents were allowed to live in Oklahoma City. He was just, again, just this incredible character who really moved the civil rights narrative of the entire country from Oklahoma City, from this place that people weren't really paying attention to and who I had never heard of before.
Sam Anderson's book is Boomtown, the fantastical saga of Oklahoma City, its chaotic founding, its purloined basketball team, and the dream of becoming a world-class metropolis.
I want to talk about the time capsule the opening of the time capsule.
The century chest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, part of the strange vibe in Oklahoma City is that it's a place whose history is so compressed, right? I mean, obviously you have the history of the place itself in the middle of the Great Plains, which goes back eons and eons. And I trace it in the book all the way back to Pangaea.
Right.
But the history of this city, is barely longer than like a human lifespan. So the history feels very alive, very present in a way that sometimes, you know, walking around New York, it's different because that the human history there, that even the European human history is so deep.
Right.
Here it's so shallow and you can kind of feel it all the time. And so one of the things that happened while I was there, I was actually there to write about basketball during the playoffs. And someone just happened to mention to me, oh, are you coming to the opening of the Century Chest tomorrow? And I had never heard of it. It was a time capsule that had been buried in 1913 that they were opening up on the anniversary of the land run, April 22nd in 2013. So it had been buried for exactly 100 years. So I went, of course. It was this huge, almost like coffin-like box that was buried at the back of a church and had been sealed under concrete. And the historians, when they dug it up, they'd use all kinds of crazy saws and drills, and they opened the box and realized that this was the best preserved time capsule anyone had ever seen. You know, because time capsules are notoriously horrible and disappointing,
sure,
and everything's ruined inside and full of mud.
Yeah,
rusty. And this thing was just pristine. I mean, everything in it was perfectly preserved, and there were, you know, newspapers that were slipped in the moment before the lid was sealed. You know, they were that fresh, and you could feel that freshness when they started pulling the items out in the church where the capsule had been buried. And so they were pulling out, you know, like a pair of shoes from one of the downtown stores, and you could just see it gleaming in the light, and everyone was just gasping. Or a woman's hat that had these artificial flowers that were so bright. It was really like 100 years had just ceased to exist in that moment. It was like we were living 100 years before. It was a very eerie, strange feeling, actually.
You wrote that a lawyer had predicted the liberation of women.
Yeah.
It was like predictions.
Yeah,
for
there
the
were
future.
All these there were all these letters that the leading citizens of Oklahoma City of 1913 had written, in some cases to specific like ancestors. And they asked various people to make predictions about what life might be like. And, you know, there was a doctor who predicted that we would have cured cancer, and he thought evolution would have progressed to the point that our heads were going to be gigantic and our eyes would be almost blind. This very weird vision.
Mm-hmm.
So there were things like that.
He forgot how not that long 100 years actually.
Yeah,
is.
Exactly.
Like so evolutionarily speaking.
There were weird things like that. And then there were one thing that blew my mind was there was actually a wax cylinder recording that the people had made of their own voices. And they had included a machine to play the cylinder on so that we could listen. And they and one of the great characters from my book, this guy named Angelo Scott, who had been in the land run of 1889, actually wrote a letter to us, which he read. It included the line,
"We who have so long been dust salute you."
Yeah, "we who have so long been dust salute you." I think he said, "Today we consciously make ancestors of ourselves." And it was just...
I cried.
Yeah.
I was reading the book.
Did you?
Not like bald, but like water happened.
Yeah.
Right here, I'm pointing to my face.
Uh-huh. I had that reaction in the room.
I bet.
Mean, it was like, again, time collapsed in a way that I have never felt time collapse before. It was really intense.
Our guest is Sam Anderson. His book, Boomtown, is published by Crown.
Let's talk about Gary England.
Yeah, so one of the characters, I think I heard on my very first trip to Oklahoma City, as I was just trying to get the lay of the land and speaking to various people in the community, somebody mentioned that really the greatest spectator sport in the state was the weather. Because, of course, it's really the center of Tornado Alley. And in spring in particular, the sky just whips up all kinds of dangerous chaos. And people are really glued to their TVs, and meteorologists in that region of the country are kind of rock stars. And the one I kept hearing about was this guy named Gary England. And he had been the lead weatherman at Channel 9 for 40 years. But there was a famous drinking game, the Gary England drinking game, that people played when severe weather came up. And I don't know how you would even survive playing that drinking game, because you'd be pretty drunk pretty fast. But he was this kind of larger-than-life figure. And so, of course, I had to go meet Gary England. And the first time I met him, actually, was in the middle of a storm. I'd come to cover for the magazine the tornadoes of May 2013, May 20th, 2013.
Right.
Which was a really tragic thing in Moore, Oklahoma. It's kind of a suburb of Oklahoma City, and destroyed two schools. And I got there the week after and had no way to predict that right when I got there, a new round of tornadoes was coming. And I drove actually directly from the airport to Gary England's studio, where I got to see him in action.
It's insanely compelling and so sort of bizarre that you're there. Mm-hmm. Like, and then he did this, and it was like this, and you could see this. I'm like, how does he know all this? Oh, he's there.
I was
at
there.
The TV station.
It was one of those incredible moments of fate in this project where I just realized, like, oh, I've been sent from space or wherever to do this project
yeah.
in my life. So, yeah, I was in the studio with Gary England as he's calling 3 days of kind of escalating tornadoes that end with what he said was the scariest tornado of his entire career. It was the widest tornado in recorded history. It was 2.6 miles wide, so it's wider than Manhattan. And it kind of did this unpredictable motion, which tornadoes are generally pretty predictable. And this one did a kind of weird jag in the middle of its motion and killed some storm chasers who were following it and trying to see it. And it was just terrifying. And I was there with him during this whole broadcast, and I was looking at the radar as the tornado was coming right at the weather center and people were evacuating into the storm shelters. And Gary England, who's this tiny man, I mean, he's this tiny blonde man, and he's just kind of standing in the middle of all these screens, speaking directly to the people of Oklahoma City, telling them what to do, telling them block by block where the tornado is at that moment.
He's really worried about people.
He's
like
really
you can
worried
tell.
About people, yeah.
He doesn't encourage the storm chasers to take risks. Like, you
right.
can tell, like, they want to, but he's like, come on, you know,
he's
a little
very
bit like, come on, chill out.
Exactly, yeah.
Don't die out there.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very old-fashioned in a way, and he lamented a lot the rise of sensationalism in weather coverage and was always telling his storm chasers to take it easy and cut down the drama and just let people know exactly where this thing was so they could be safe. And Gary England was shaken by this storm. And so I was there until he staggered out of his little command module when the tornado finally lifted. And it was late at night. He had been just for a couple of weeks on the most intense, you know, reporting jag you can imagine. And he just looked like the most exhausted human I've ever seen. And I remember asking him, I said, Gary, what do you even do after a session like this? Like, how do you process it? And he kind of sighed heavily and he said, well, I'm going to do what I always do. I'm going to have a glass of red wine and eat a huge plate of nachos. And then
I can't believe it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's amazing.
I describe this in the book. And then I watched him walk out and get in his car and drive out into the hardest rain I've ever seen in my life. It was still just this flash flooding like crazy at that point. And that was it. He said, as soon as he got in the car, he said, he's done. And he retired. That was his final tornado. Walking around with Gary around Oklahoma City since that time, It is like walking around with a rock star. People, we go into a restaurant and people just come up to him and say, "Oh, Gary, we miss you." And he would always say, "I miss me too." And the waitress would, you know, make me take their picture together in the booth. And yeah, he was a real character.
So, but he's not the only rock star you hang out with in Oklahoma City.
Oh, good segue.
Thank you. Wayne Coyne, Flaming Lips.
Yep. So the great alternative rock band, the Flaming Lips, is from Oklahoma City. And unlike almost every other artistic young person, they never left. They stayed. And Wayne, in particular, just kind of anchored down in the neighborhood that he grew up in, which is a pretty economically depressed, kind of rough neighborhood right in the center of the city. And he bought a house there for very, very cheap in the 90s. And then as the band had more success, he bought the houses around it and he kind of connected them all and combined them into what is known as the compound. And he's this extremely flamboyant, like psychedelic character. So the compound is painted all these bizarre colors. It was just in the middle of this rundown kind of residential neighborhood. And then suddenly you see, like, you know, giant glitter balls and peacocks and colorfully painted, like he paints the actual trees in his yard. So yeah, Wayne Coyne, and you see him all over town. He's got this huge poofy curly hair and he's got glitter on his face and painted fingernails, and he's just like this wild character in this place that is otherwise so conservative and kind of this drab concrete city. He'll walk up to anyone and let you take a selfie with him. He kind of loves it.
Sure.
So yeah, I got to know Wayne pretty well, and we hung around and did some crazy things together.
You wrote about driving up to the compound at night. Suddenly, out of nowhere, my lights sent up a burst of glitter because there's disco balls all in the yard.
Yeah.
But that, I loved that. It's a very beautiful sentence, Sam. Like,
thank
I
you.
Really, I was like, I can see it.
Oh, thanks.
And I love it.
Thank you.
So you mentioned, like, hanging out with Wayne Coyne, walking around with Gary England. You hang out with Sam Presti, well, not hang out with Sam Presti, but talk to Sam Presti of the Thunder.
Yep.
Did anybody treat you like an interloper, or was it cool that you were curious?
I would say almost universally, people were just excited to have me around and interested.
Well, because you're so cool.
I don't think it's because I'm so cool. I appreciate that. I don't think that's it. I think it's because, again, as we were saying before, it's a place that is so used to being overlooked and that has this kind of inferiority complex.
Right. It's striving.
It's striving. It wants to be a major American metropolis, and it always has. And I always take that right back to the Land Run, where it's this place that is founded in a way that should not have happened and in the worst possible way to found a city. And at such a late date in human and American history that, in fact, it was just swarming with media. Like, the Land Run was covered by Harper's Weekly and all these other magazines. And so it's a place that is, from the moment of its conception, intensely self-conscious and wants to be thought of as a real place, not a fake weird place. And so,
and then it proceeds to be so weird.
I know. So yeah, some people take that word weird as an insult. I always think of it as a compliment. But
right.
And so I think people were mostly just happy that I, you know, who am affiliated with this gigantic institution, the New York Times, wanted to spend so much time there and was just so curious to meet everybody I could meet and learn all the stories I could learn. And so I think people were somewhat flattered by that, and they were just ready to tell their stories and to share the city.
It is a wonderful book. I was reading it on a plane, and I said to my husband, who was next to me, next trip, we're going to Oklahoma City. And he, because he is my husband, so he gets me and we are simpatico. He was like, yeah, okay. And
nice.
He's going to read the book and then
nice.
We're going to go. I love it so much. And I'm really, really grateful that you took the time to come talk with me
Thank
about
you
it.
Very
Thank
much.
You, Sam.
Thanks.
Sam Anderson is the author of Boomtown, The Fantastical Saga of Oklahoma City, its chaotic founding, its purloined basketball team, and the dream of becoming a world-class metropolis. The book is published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.